Hey y'all, I'm Robbie. I'm alcoholic. How's this? How's this? So my sobriety date's December 15th, 1987. I like to read this. This is something I learned from Polly P. Some of y'all know Polly. She likes to say it this way, and I like to do it this way when I tell my story. I've heard lots of great stories in my time. I've heard entertaining stories, I've heard dramatic stories, I've heard all sorts. But for me and for her, it's about this, and it's on page 29 in the big book. It says, each individual in their personal stories describes in his own language, from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. So my goal is to do that. And I have an experience with that AA gave me, and I'm going to try to do it that way. First of all, I'm really grateful for this place. I've been on a diet for 4 months. I've lost, on Friday, I had lost 40 pounds. I'm pretty sure I've lost 35 pounds now. So appreciate the food. Really appreciate Scott's work over there. Tapers are very important people. And I don't even know what we call them now. We can't call them tapers anymore. We got a MP3ers are really important to us. And, recorders people. I'm grateful for Joe for not wearing a tie because I forgot mine. The word for the day wasn't even told, but for me, I listened to words of the day. The word of the day wasn't Carmen's words. It was the lady that, I can't remember who it was that introduced Carmen. Somebody, I think it was you. It was nefarious. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it's my word. Yesterday it was distracted because Ray talked about us being distracted, and I've been distracted. He also talked about excitement, and I like the 11th step idea of being excited and that we're in much less danger of excitement when we're doing this work. I heard a guy that was brand new in recovery probably 25 years ago talk about being excited into a relapse. That made a lot of sense to me because I don't know too many people that relapse over bad things. They relapse over good things. It's amazing to see that happen. A good, exciting thing that will get to us without recovery, it'll make recovery, a drink's much better when you're excited. So, and we think the excitement will be better until about 15 minutes later, and then we go, shit. I'm supposed to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now, but my real story is what I was like, what happened, what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And so it was real kind of weird like that. I think I've had an exciting life. It's been very eventful. So here we go. I was born in Columbus, Georgia. I'm the son of an alcoholic, and my father was the alcoholic in my house. I was a guy that was born with it. I come from a long line of alcoholics. In fact, I went through the trouble of tracing my family tree as it relates to alcoholism, and the last guy I can get to was a guy named John Keeble, who was a guy from 1611, who actually has a hymnal in the Methodist hymn book, who was a professor at Oxford in England, who was an alcoholic. It turns out I come from a long line of Methodist preachers and alcoholics, and a bunch of them are both. And so that's kind of where I came from. So I was talking to somebody last night about, some of y'all got this period of social drinking. I didn't get that. So I'll talk about that. What I want to do is talk about the first time I drank, the last day I drank, and then what happened to me after that. So I was raised in a situation with my alcoholic daddy where I learned by the age of 10-ish some attitudes and some ideas that stuck with me and stick with me to this day sometimes. And some of y'all will be able to relate, most of you will, but it was basically because of who I am as a genetically altered person or because of my environment growing up in an alcoholic family environment. I gained some attitudes really quick. One of them was, any minute something bad's going to happen. And the other one was, if you knew me, you wouldn't like me. And I hear that over and over and over again in different ways from other alcoholics around the world. And so I went through the process of being afraid all the time. I was very comfortable in two places, church and baseball field. I'm a church guy. I like it. I always have. I just do. I like everything about it. I always have. I was really good in baseball growing up. I was good enough to play through college and a couple of years professionally, and I was good at it. And so I felt normal in a church and on a baseball field and nowhere else. So I wanted to be a good boy, if that makes any sense to you guys. I wanted to be a good kid. And so I had made this decision, watching my dad's alcoholism, and he was a serious alcoholic. For instance, you know, the reason I was afraid something bad might happen any minute now is because my dad had this habit of, I thought he slept in the road a lot. Turned out he passed out in the road a lot out in front of our house. I used to think we were from the hood. There were seven of us in a three-bedroom, one-bath house. It was a little wooden house. I used to say I was from the hood. It turns out I'm from the woods on the other side of the hood. The dirt road part, you know, that's where I came from. And so we were pretty poor folks. And so I felt less than a lot. But my dad would pass out there, and that felt weird. And he'd also do other weird things, like go to the bathroom in the house where there wasn't one. And, you know, things happen. And I was afraid to let anybody around me in my home because they wouldn't like me if they knew. And so I got that fear thing. My mother was also crazy as hell. I mean, she was, excuse my language, but for the first 10 years of my life, she was a mean, vengeful, angry bitch. I mean, crazy. And in 1964, she went to Al-Anon. And I'm telling you, in the course of 2 years of my life and her life, she turned into one of the most beautiful, caring, loving women I've ever known. And I credit that to y'all, to the Al-Anon folks in the world, in the house. She took me to Al-Anon meetings a lot, and so I grew up around Al-Anon folks. And my mother's name was Bonnell. Some of y'all might have known her. She's from Georgia. They called her Nellie. And she was one of those women that liked to control her sponsees. The day she died, I had to do her eulogy, and about 50 Al-Anon showed up at her funeral, and they were scared to death because they didn't know what to do. And they were like, they ran up to me and said, "What are we supposed to do? We don't have Nellie to tell us what to do anymore." And I'm like, so I got to the eulogy part, and I just looked at them and went, "You know, if you just be still and listen, you can hear her talk to you." And to this day, I can hear my mother talk to me, and it's y'all that gave her that language, and so it saved my life later on, which I'll get to. 14, in my hometown, if you were good at something, there wasn't a school district that made you go geographically to a school. If you were good at something in Columbus, Georgia, they would just send you to wherever you were good at. If they were good at that there, that's where you went. I was good in baseball, so I went to what was at the time the number one high school in the state of Georgia, and it had been for a long time in baseball. And it turns out it was also the most affluent public school in the state at the time. It was pre-private school stuff much. It was before forced busing and integration, although my particular school was already integrated, which I was grateful for because Fort Benning is in Columbus. But they didn't have that separation of things like they do today. And it was so, I mean, when I tell you they were affluent, my classmates were the children of the founder of Aflac, Charbroil, what's the bank? I forgot. A big bank, Hughes Plumbing, the Rothschild Company, Jordan Company. One of my classmates is the founder of Realtree. Some of y'all hunters know what that is. But, so I go to school the first day from the woods on the other side of the hood, and I walk in this classroom at 14, and I've got on a pair of kids, which will become important later. This was 1968. kids were not cool. We called them buddies back then, and everybody else had on, I had on a pair of kids, a pair of blue jeans, and a wide plaid shirt with an open collar, no button-down collar. Everybody else, it seemed like, had on a pair of penny loafers, a pair of khakis, an Izod shirt with an alligator belt and a gold belt buckle with their initials on it. I looked at them and I went, oh, no, where am I? And they looked at me like, where in the hell did he come from? By lunchtime, I'd been hit in the head with a basketball in the gym and laughed at in the lunchroom and had food thrown on me. And I was really aware all of a sudden that I wasn't good enough. And if they get to know me, they won't like me. And this is a terrible place for me to be, and bad stuff's going to happen to me. I had this thing inside of me that I was born with. It was I felt less than and insecure and apart from and uncomfortable all the time. But I wanted to be a good boy, and I did not have any intention of ever drinking alcohol because I'd seen what it had done to my father, and that wasn't happening. And I was really good in baseball, and people had told me, you're going to play professional baseball, and I saw that as my way out. And so I wasn't going to screw it up. Fast forward. 3 years of hell, I got to be a junior. At the end of my junior year, I got selected All-State in baseball. And all of a sudden, all those rich kids wanted me around them because I was popular all of a sudden because I had something, you know, that was important to them. Also started dating the best-looking girl in the high school. Back then, I had hair and was in good shape. And so she really was. She was, if you know, this is crazy to me, but Darlene was her name, and she was half Cherokee Indian and half Irish. If you know anything about alcoholism, that's number one and two on the hit list. And so she was also a cheerleader and a majorette and was in really good shape. And I'm dating the best-looking girl in the school, and I'm star athlete. But I was so angry at everybody else that I was just pissed all the time. Fast forward another year, and I get to be a senior, and it's in May of 1972, and I'm making a decision between college baseball and professional baseball, and I'd been recruited by all these schools. And one day I was in the gym working out, getting ready. It was in May of 72, and I'm getting ready to figure out what I'm going to do, and I'm trying to stay in shape, and we're playing in the state tournament and all that stuff. And these two twin brothers came by the school, Mike and Pat. Their mother and father had gone on a cruise, and nobody was at home at their house. So very quickly, the senior party became their house, and I knew what that meant. So about 1 o'clock that afternoon, Mike and Pat came by the school to get me and said, they were like, come on, man, everybody's going over to our house. We're going to have a party. It's going to be great. Come on. And I went, no, I'm not going. I'm going to be okay. You know what I'm trying to do. I'm not screwing this up. About 3 o'clock, Mike came back by the school to give it some context for you older folks in a brand new SS-396 Chevelle. Y'all remember those? The white ones with the black stripes down the front. So there he is, and out of the back seat steps Darlene, the best-looking girl in the school, and she says, Robbie, I'm going. I want you to go too. And I went, okay. All of a sudden, it sounded like a great idea, and I'm not blaming her for any of this. In fact, we're still really good friends. But we went to this party, and I walk in there, and there's about 75, it seemed like, rich kids and me. And Darlene. And Darlene had already been drinking some. I didn't really know that, but she'd been hitting it a little bit. And she walked over to me and handed me a Dixie cup of blended whiskey. And I drank it because she was drinking it. And I drank it, and I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't like the way it smelled. I didn't like the way it felt going down. And she handed me another one, and I drank it. I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't like the way it smelled. I didn't like the way it felt going down. About 2 minutes later, something happened. The way I like to explain it is, y'all, I'm going to step back from the mic just a bit, but this is what it sounded like. Y'all might can relate to this sound. So I drank it, and it sounded like this. Whew! Whew! I went from less than, apart from, insecure and uncomfortable and afraid right through normal. And I am bulletproof, invisible, and 10 feet tall. The way I remember it, no joke, was I was in this room with 50 people that I wasn't good enough for. And all of a sudden, I knew that there was some really important stuff I needed to tell them. And I knew that they wanted to hear me tell them. And I knew it was going to be great. And so I started talking. Some people say I haven't shut up since then. But I know this today. I didn't know it then. But what it created in me, not just a sense of ease and comfort, but I felt superior. I didn't feel equal to those kids. I felt better than them, which I hate to admit it, but that was awesome. Because I'd never felt that anywhere except for on a baseball field. And the other part was that I didn't feel less than and apart from and uncomfortable and afraid. I like to call it the double-edged sword of obsession. I was from that day forward, I obsessed against that feeling for a little while, and then I would all of a sudden obsess toward that feeling. And the only thing that would accomplish that was a couple of drinks of blended whiskey for a good little while. So that was my first drink. And it did something for me, or my second drink. It did something for me that nothing ever has before until a lot later. So fast forward, I got drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals. And instead of going professional, I was 17. I was a little young to go play professional baseball. So back then what they would do is they would make a generous contribution to a community, a junior college in the South Georgia, North Florida NCAA Division IV school down there. And it was really a mini camp for professional baseball players. We'd go to school at junior college for 2 years and then go play professional baseball. I think it's an NCAA violation. I'm not sure. But that's what I did. And so I'm down there. On September the 14th, 1972, I turned 18. And in Georgia, on September the 15th, 1972, they changed the drinking age to 18 for 10 years or so. Vietnam stuff. And all of a sudden, I was off at school. I had legal status. I knew what alcohol could do for me. And my schedule very quickly turned into 3 hours of class, 3 hours of baseball, and where's the cheap beer tonight? And I turned into a 3 six-pack-a-day drunk for a good while. 2 months into that drill, y'all know the thing. I know it from training. I'm a clinician. From training, it's basically this. 2 months into the deal, your tolerance starts to build up to alcohol pretty quick, and your brain normalizes itself toward the new norm. It's called homeostasis, basically. But anyway, I'll get back to me. The thing is that it stopped doing what it had done. What used to get me to right here was only getting me to right here, so y'all know what I did. You increase the dose and the frequency is what you do. And then 2 months later, it does it again until sooner or later, you just burn out all those receptor sites and dopamine receptors in your prefrontal cortex and your limbic system gets all haywire and you're just nuts to the point where it doesn't do it anymore. And so all of a sudden, 7 or 8 months into the deal, I can't get any of the effect I'm looking for. I can get about a 15 or 20 minute buzz and then nothing, and before that, what I could get was about a 15 or 20 minute buzz and then a 30 to 45 minute sense of ease and comfort. But I couldn't get the ease and comfort anymore. And I kept trying to get it because my brain's telling me, you can get it, you can get it. And I drink and then the craving would set in and I'm off to the races. And so 8 months into the deal, I was off at school, 1973 by then. There was this kid in our school, his name was Hippie Dave. He was from Dayton, Ohio, and he would come back with the best pot you've ever smoked in your life back then. And so I learned about the marijuana maintenance plan real quick. But I was still drinking every day, and then later on it turned into other drugs, and alcohol just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse. I went back to school. Made it through school somehow, played some baseball, got through with that, went back to Columbus, became an athletic person in my hometown. I coached a while and did an administrative deal with athletic director job. And In that same period of time, I became in love with a woman that I'd gone to high school with, not my high school sweetheart, but another person. This was 1976. She was a very, very, very good woman. Just incidentally, I'm not trying to name drop necessarily, but she was Jimmy Carter's cousin. And so we got married in 1980. Somehow I was able to hide my alcoholism and other addictions from her because she drank too a lot. So we decided to get married. There was this deal. There were about 1,000 or 1,500 or so people at the wedding, and the president was there. I mean, you know, it was crazy. And CNN showed up. It was nuts. So we're so hungover, and so I was drunk, she was hungover. Mary Beth Cunningham, who is a famous opera singer, sang the Lord's Prayer at our wedding. And we're on our knees at the altar, and I look at Louisa, and I say, I can't get up. She looked at me and goes, me neither. So Mary Beth gets through singing, and we're just there, you know. So we finally get up, and so my first marriage, which is important to me, about this part, about my recovery anyway, was just a production of, you know, I was on display and it was a production thing. So that marriage was pretty good. It got really ugly really quick. 1983 came along, and here's what happened. I'd started trying to be a sober person in 1980 after 8 years of active alcoholism. And I tried to stop, and I could not stop. And I was also heavily into other drugs. And I kept trying and kept trying and kept trying. One day, it seemed like it happened in the same day. It was 1983. I decided, this was my first venture into geographic cure. I decided that I needed to find a new career, move to a different place, be around good people, and to become a good person and change my life. It seemed like the next day, I'm sitting in my office at work, and a guy walks into my office that I knew from church. His name was Jim Terry. Jim Terry was the scout executive for the Southeast region. And he says, Robbie, have you ever thought about becoming a Boy Scout executive? And my thought was, hell yeah, those are good people. I can be a good person. I can find a new life. And then he said, if you want to do this, we'll talk about it. And we talked about it. And they hired me to be a Boy Scout executive. Now, I didn't tell you this part. In 1977, my alcoholism and addiction got so out of control that I couldn't keep up with it. And so I decided to become part owner of a rock and roll club in Columbus because that's where all the good drugs were and I could drink for free. And so I decided to change my life and become a Boy Scout executive. And they hired me, and they said, you can do this, but you got to move to LaGrange, Georgia, which is 40 miles away. And so the Boy Scout drug addict thing wasn't going to go well, and the Boy Scout nightclub owner wasn't going to go well, so I had to sell my share in the club. But when I retired from the nightclub business, my going away party was incredibly crazy. But my present from this place was that I can drink there for free for the rest of my life. That place is still there. It's a strip joint now, but it's still there. Same guy owns it. It was a huge venue for rock and roll, one of the better ones, biggest club south of Atlanta in Georgia. It was a really good one. And I'll just quickly fast forward. When I was 17 years sober, I decided to take a venture back into that club one day just to see what it would be like. Hadn't been in there in 17 years, and I walk in there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a strip joint now. And I didn't know that strip joints, they start early. But I walk in there, and I'm telling you, I open the door, and there were about 6 guys sitting at the bar, and they turn around and go, Robbie, where you been? 17 years later, I turn around and ran out the door, and I'm like, oh, don't go in there. So I went to LaGrange. It turns out that it's only 40 miles away. So I wound up in Columbus 3 or 4 nights a week. And by 1985, things went south real bad with Louisa, and she decided to leave. I won't get into that part of my story, but it was ugly. If y'all ever heard somebody say, I know you have, all you alcoholics, if you ever do this again, I'm leaving. Well, I'd heard that a bunch. But this particular day, I'd been gone for about 2.5 days. And when I came home, it was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And Louisa looked at me without tears, without emotion, without anything, and very matter-of-factly said, "Robbie, if you ever do this again, I'm leaving." And so the next day, this was a Friday, the next day, Saturday, was the first Carter family reunion for a very long time. This is 1985. And it was in Atlanta area. And I was supposed to go with Louisa to the Carter reunion. And she was really excited about going. And so we get out. And I was too. And I promised her that I would never drink again. That night I said, "Okay, I'm done. I'll never drink again. I'll quit somehow. I'll never do it." Because I didn't want to lose her. So the next day we get up and we're getting dressed and she's running late. And this idea hit me from somewhere. And it was like, "Well, it's late. We need to hurry." And I said, "Louisa, I'm going to go fill up with gas. I'll be right back." And it didn't occur to her. And I said, "Yeah, I'll be." So on the way to the, I guess it's called convenience store now. Back then we called them gas stations. But I'm on the way and I'm thinking, okay, a couple of beers would really help for the ride. And so I got there and I bought a couple of beers and drank them. About halfway through the second beer, the thought was, if I really hurry, I can go get some of my, I call them dry goods, and the white ones. And so at 5 o'clock the next morning, I showed back up at my house, and Louisa was gone, and that was the last time I lived in the same place with her. I don't know if y'all have been through that experience, but when you lose the love of your life and you're in a bed at 5 o'clock in the morning and you know that you've just screwed up your entire life, it is all, especially when you're that high, it is awful. It was the worst day of my life at the time. You would think that I would have done something about that then, as bad as it was, and I did decide that I'm going to go to a meeting because I knew from my dad's experience with his alcoholism and my mother's Al-Anon experience and going to Al-Anon meetings half my life that I could probably use an AA meeting. And so I decided I'm going to go to an AA meeting, but I couldn't go to one in LaGrange or Columbus because they knew me there. And so I drove about 40 more miles up the road to Carrollton, and I go into this AA meeting, and I walk in there, and I say, they say, "You know, are there any visitors or newcomers?" And I say, "I'm Robbie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from LaGrange, and I've been sober for 3 years, and I'm glad to be here." And at the end of the meeting, I picked up a white chip. Back then, they were white poker chips. And there's a guy in there named Nick. He looked at me like, "You are crazy." And so I left and realized that when I left that I just lied to them and they knew it, so I couldn't go back there. And so I started drinking again that day. And that period from sometime in 1985 to late 1987, I like to call my period of drinking with complete abandon. It was basically, my life's finished, my marriage is finished, I'm not going to be able to quit doing this, so I'm drinking and using drugs, and y'all need to get over it. And I drank every day, all day, work, wherever I was high. And I was drinking all the time. To the point where, in those 2 years, the divorce happened, I got a warrant for my arrest for writing bad checks. I got $87,000 worth of bad debt, mostly for drugs and alcohol and just stuff I spent money on credit cards and that sort of thing. I was back behind on my rent by 3 or 4 months because they kept thinking that the Boy Scout executive is going to pay. You know, I didn't pay. I was psychotic about half the time, delusional most of the time, and drunk all the time. And one day, and it was December the 12th, 1987, it was a Sunday, I was so out of it and so tired that I went home to a place where I hadn't been in about 3 or 4 weeks, and I decided, okay, this is my plan. My brother lived in San Antonio, Texas. He was my best friend. My younger, he still to this day is my best friend. He lives outside of Big Canoe, Georgia now. And I said, my thought was, okay, I'm going to move to Texas, and I'm going to talk to Jeff, and I'm probably going to learn how to be a good person again. So I'll become a youth director of a church. And so I'm going to go over there and tell him what's happened to me, and I'm going to get it all together. You know, insanity. And so I get a one-way. What I did was I packed up this. The car had been repossessed. They just hadn't found it yet. So I get in my car, and I drive to Atlanta to go to the airport. I get a one-way ticket to San Antonio, Texas, because I'm not coming back. And I had some clothes left, and that car was left, and I had probably $1,500 left to my name, which was probably a bad check. Back then, they would cash checks for the Boy Scout exec. All I had to do was put on a Boy Scout uniform and go to anywhere they'd cash check. It was stupid. The one that got me in trouble was actually for groceries. All the ones for drugs, I didn't get a warrant for. I got one for damn groceries. So I think that's funny. But anyway, it was... So I get on the plane, I fly to San Antonio, I get off the plane, I drive over to my brother's house in a rental car, and I forgot one detail. I didn't call my brother. He wasn't home. So I sat on his porch for I don't even know how long, and finally, this is what happened. Y'all know how we obsess over stuff, really intensely obsess over stuff? Well, I was obsessing like crazy, and I decided... Well, let me back up. I'm not through. I skipped a big old giant part of my story. I need to back up. When I left my house, I was headed to Atlanta. I got to Fairburn. This is crazy. I forgot this part. I got to Fairburn, Georgia. I had drank a whole bunch on the way, and I'd used a whole bunch of other stuff. And so I pulled off the side of the road, and I decided to check in this hotel. It was a Knights Inn hotel. Y'all know what those are? It's like modular hotels. One day there's a field, next day there's a hotel. They were terrible places. But anyway, I checked in. I remember to this day, it was room 42. I checked into this place, and it was a dark, dingy, off the side of the interstate hotel room. And what I remember is I had about three cases of beer or more, and I had, I hate to talk about drugs too much, but I'll just say it. I had somewhere in excess of a quarter ounce of cocaine. So I check into this hotel, and I didn't have a plan to kill myself. I just didn't have a plan to come back out. And so I go in there, and I start using and drinking like crazy, and I used to tell people when I told my story that I used all that. But the truth is I don't know. I got real, 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 real high and drunk, and I blacked out and got psychotic really bad. And I don't know what happened from late in the day on the 12th. And on about 3 o'clock in the morning on the 15th of December, I woke up in that hotel room, and all the drugs and alcohol were gone. I don't know. I could have gotten paranoid and flushed it. I have no clue what happened. I still, to this day, I really don't know what happened. But I was there, and I was desperate, and it was dark, and I sat on the side of the bed. And the other weird thing is I'd never in that whole period of time stopped going to church. I never stopped trying to be a good person. Basically, what I was doing was living a double life. I was a Boy Scout executive, church administrator by day, and I was a nightclub operating drug addict alcoholic every night for most of those years. And it was awful. The amount of guilt and shame you feel when you're trying to live one life and you're really living another one is just terrible. And so I sat there on the bed after I came to because I was surprised I didn't die. And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and prayed about it. I wrote about it. Oddly, I didn't know anything about writing inventory. I wrote this letter to my mother. By this time, my mother was a black belt Al-Anon. I mean, in your face Al-Anon lady. And so I'm writing this letter, I'm just writing it out, and I mailed it to her. It was an 11-page letter. So after that, I'm sitting there, it's like 4 hours later, it's daylight, and I'm praying, and the thought hit me, this is my story, I get to tell it this way. This thought came to my mind, okay, I need to figure out what I need to do here, and God needs to help me or I'm going to die. And so I reached over into the nightstand, and I picked up a Gideon Bible. And I opened it up like to nowhere, and it turned out it was the 51st Psalm. I can paraphrase it to you. It says basically in part of that Psalm, the 10th verse, I think, it says, Create in me a clean heart, O God. Put into me a new and right spirit. Restore to me the joy of my salvation and give me peace. And my thought was, that would be the most awesome experience I could ever have. And my second thought was, it's too late for that. I've gone too far. I can't have that anymore. And I felt hopeless, tremendously hopeless. So I kept reading. The end of that psalm says, the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken and contrite spirit. Oddly, that gave me hope, because I'm broken and contrite as I can get. And so I thought, okay, I can do this. And that's when I got the thought of, I'll go to San Antonio, Texas. I can't believe I left that part of my story out. So I go to San Antonio, and I'm there, and I'm sitting on the porch, and I'm obsessing. And the obsession was, okay, I really don't know what to do, and so I'm going to tell Jeff the whole story, and I'm going to do whatever he says. So he gets there about 7 o'clock that night, and I sit down. I said, Jeff, I need to tell you something. And he says, so are you finally ready to quit? And I'm thinking, he knows, you know, and I said, yes. I told him the whole story. And then my brother looked at me, excuse the language again. He says, Robbie, you stupid son of a bitch. You call mother right now and you do whatever she says. So I get up and go to the phone, call my mother. My mother says, black belt mother says, come home. And I said, yes, ma'am. So I get in the car, go back to the airport, buy a one-way ticket back to Georgia, get out, go home to the house I was raised in Columbus. I walk into the house and my mother goes like this. She grabbed me, took me to a treatment center where I wound up as a hospital-based treatment center. They took me to ICU because I was crazy as I get. My liver was weird and all kind of crazy health issues. And I went to, they put me in this treatment center on the third floor after 3 days. And it turned out it was the luckiest thing that's ever happened to me. It was a treatment center where every single person in there was in recovery. Nurses, doctors, counselors, janitor, everybody was in AA, every one of them. The doctor was in Al-Anon, Dr. Miller. And they taught me about y'all. They took me to my first meeting after I'd been there for a week. My second meeting, the first one was the one I lied in. I go to a meeting in Phoenix City, Alabama. It's called the Serenity Group. It meets above a pool hall. I think it still meets there. But anyway, there was a guy in there. His name's Lou and his wife. And he had on a pair of overalls and a pair of boots. It was January by then. He had on a pair of boots and a pair of overalls and a red jersey. And the guy right next to him had on the same thing. I'm thinking, this is an AA uniform. So I used to wear that when I told my story. I don't do it anymore, but it's just funny to me. So, but I'm in this meeting, and I'm detoxed, and I'm not insane anymore as far as psychosis. And they read how it works. And I didn't hear any of it, and Wes was reading it, and he said, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, but God could and would if he were sought. And all of a sudden, I knew that I was in the right place. That's why I tell people, listen to the stories, listen to the reading at the beginning, because it'll change your life sometimes. Also, I'm a fan of ritual in spiritual things. I happen to practice contemplative Christianity, which is Thomas Keating and Richard Rohr and, you know, that crowd. I do that a lot. And it's all about contemplative ritual, prayer, meditation. And I like the how it works thing at the beginning of meetings. You know why it's important for us to read that at the beginning of the meeting and to read what we read? Because it lets you arrive at the meeting, lets you get there. It's the reason they have ritual at the beginning of church services. It lets you get there. We have our own ritual here, and they're very important, and it saved me. So I start going to meetings. I really love meetings. This makes some of y'all sick, but I bought in immediately. I was done drinking. I was done. I wasn't coming to AA for the first 15 years of my active alcoholism because my dad had gone to detox 15 times in my younger life. He was a VA detox guy, in and out. He would go to AA for 45 days, never talk to anybody, never get a sponsor, never work the steps, get drunk, repeat. Had seizure disorder. By the time I got sober and was sober for a couple of years, he got diagnosed with alcoholic dementia and spent the rest of his life with dementia from alcoholism and died 20 years later. So for me, AA was not work. It didn't work, but I had nowhere to go. It was the last place they took me, and I heard Wes read. And so I started going to meetings. I was still in treatment when this happened to me. This is about sponsorship. I was, how long do I have? We started at 20 after or something, 25 after. Okay. Sorry, it's late, y'all. I know that. But so I'm in the counselor's office. I'm sitting there. My counselor's a guy named Clark, who I knew from high school, and he'd been sober for about 12 years. And I'm sitting there talking to him, and this guy walks in behind me, and I turn around, and it's a guy that I used to play Little League with, that I used to get drunk with all the time in that club I was telling y'all about. His name's Joe Lauderdale. And Joe and Clark looks at me and says, "Robbie, you know Joe?" I said, "Yeah, I know Joe. Joe's a good guy." And he said, "I think Joe's going to be your sponsor." And I turn around, I said, "Joe, where you been?" He says, "I've been right here waiting on you, buddy." And I said, "Are you going to be my sponsor?" He said, "Mm-hmm." So I like to tell people I didn't find somebody I could relate to. I got assigned a sponsor. You know, this is your sponsor. I said, "Okay." So Joe looked at me and he said, just like this, "Are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol?" And I said, And he goes, "Are you sure?" He said it like that. I said, "Yes." He said, "Okay, there's some things you got to do." I said, "Okay." He said, "I want you to go to an AA meeting every day when you get out of here at noon." The Agape Club was downtown. I said, "Okay." He said, "And I want you to go to an NA meeting every night at 8 o'clock, because I'm both. I thought, "Well, that sounds like a lot." And he said, "It ain't a lot. You want me to sponsor you? That's what you're going to." I said, okay. And he said, "After the noon meeting, I want you to come by my office, and we're going to read the big book, and we're going to do what it says together." I said, "Okay." I think it's a unique experience that I've never heard of before, but it's what I do with sponsees, if I can, more than most people. But I went by his office every day after that meeting. And if he was in his office, I would call him. If he was in his office, I would go by there, and I would be there about 4 days a week. And we would sit down in his office and read the big book, and we would do exactly what the big book said to do when we got to the part that said do something. If it said pray, we prayed. If it said do this, we did this. Whatever it said, we did it. We took the actions in the book. I like to say this. Most people don't think it's that funny. I think it's hilarious. Joe ran the largest liquor store in the city. It's called Little Joe's Party Shop. The largest liquor store in the whole town. I got sober and worked the steps in a liquor store. So I was in the office, but it was in a liquor store. But Joe saved my life. He did the most loving thing any man's ever done for me, ever. He sat down with me, because I was too psychotic to read the book, and not psychotic, but I couldn't understand. You know how we can't pay attention so forever, can't comprehend anything. Well, he would read it to me out loud, and I would listen to him read it, and he'd stop every two paragraphs and say, "This is what this means. This is what we do. This is how I did it. This is what we're going to do." I said, "Okay." And so we went through that process. It took about 6 weeks, because we were meeting 3 or 4 days a week. By then, I'd gotten to the eighth step, and the obsession to drink and use was gone, and it has never come back. So we get a little bit further down the road, and we're going to meetings together every day. And let me stop right here and get philosophical with you just for a second. I happen to be from the Christian faith, and it's a contemplative faith that I practice. But we got to step two, and it says, you know, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I looked at Joe and said, "Joe, I have no problem with that. I'm a Christian." He said, "Shit." And I went, "What's wrong with that?" He said, "Nothing's wrong with that, except you can't quit drinking." And I went, "Oh." He said, I bought this somehow, because I was really into the church. He said, "You're going to have to entertain the idea. You're going to have to get so open-minded that you're going to have to entertain the idea that everything you've been taught and that you believe could be bullshit and start from right here and have a whole new experience with this program and that if you want to, and see what's really real for you. That's an exercise in open-mindedness I don't hear a lot in AA. I usually hear the opposite of that, which is, I tried church and it didn't work. Church is all bullshit. I came to AA and it saved my life. I've got the opposite experience. So it's both closed-minded as hell. It's just that we have to come to something else, which is a new experience with an open mind. I love the set-aside prayer. Y'all have all heard it. Well, I get to have a new experience because I get to set aside everything I think I know. It's a funny thing about being sober for 37 years. I think I know every word of the big book. But every once in a while, I got to do it again and get a new experience because I have to set it aside and start fresh, which is what I do about once a year. So we get through the process, and I'm open-minded, and I'm working through the deal, and here's what I believe. He got me to a place where he got me to generically look at God. Because I had tried like crazy to have a relationship with God, how I came to know God through the church, and I could never get there. I could never actually achieve that relationship fully in that way, although I loved it. So I got so open-minded that I was able to go, and he got me back to this idea for me, and it works for me, and I'm going to share it with you. At a very generic place in AA, I came to believe that a power greater than me is the place where I find hope, direction, and purpose in life. And so the practice was, where does that come from, and how do you experience that? And so after step two, he said, okay, what I want you to do is now I want you to go to meeting every day, just like you've been doing. And I want you, before you walk into the room, I want you to pray that you will listen and hear what you need to hear, and you will experience that God of yours and what other people are saying. And I want you to listen intently to what every single person says. I was crazy, so this is what it looked like. Somebody would talk and I'd go, if they were behind me, I did it like this. Because I was nuts. And so people said, who is that guy? But about the fifth meeting I'm sitting in, I'm picking up 30 days because I'd been in treatment for a while, and in walks Nick from Noonan, the guy that I picked up a white chip from when I was lying. And he looks at me like, I wonder where you'd get back. I said, yeah, it was kind of crazy. He said, no joke. So I went to meetings for 30 days, and I prayed before I went in, and I listened intently to what every person had to say. And about 25 or 30 days into that deal, I'm sitting in a meeting, and I'm feeling something different. And what I'm feeling is hopeful. My second step does not sound like I came to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity, because I already believed in God. What happened was I came to hope that if I did what you guys are doing, I could be sober like y'all. And a little bit later, I came to hope that if I kept doing what you guys were doing, that I could be happy, because y'all looked happy to me. And a year or so later, I came to hope because of y'all that if I really applied myself and kept doing what y'all were doing, that I could have a successful life. And all that's happened for me, every bit of it. And so the first piece of the power became hope. Would y'all agree that hope is a powerful thing? Well, it came from the fellowship. So part one of my power comes from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the process of working the steps with Joe, we got to step 10 and 11. In the process, I'm making amends to people right and left, paying back, you know, people I owe, and making deals with them right and left, getting myself out from going to prison for writing bad checks and all that stuff. And I don't have time to tell you about a lot of this stuff, so I'm going to do the best I can. But we get to step 10 and 11, and what Joe practiced with me was, you know, step 10 and 11 is really interesting. It tells you what to do when you wake up in the morning. It tells you what to do to plan your day. It tells you what to do to get the very best attitude you can have for your day. It tells you how to stop during the day and assess how you're doing and correct where you screw up your day and to try to improve your day as you go forward. And then it tells you how to review your day at the end so you can go to bed at night with some gratitude and a clear heart, and you can sleep better. I can't think of a better way to structure a day than that. I can't. We do all sorts of occupations. I was a hospital administrator by then, or a little bit after then. And so for me, it was go to work every day and have appointments all day and talk to people all day and try to be, run my division of this hospital system I'm working for. And I'm really busy, but every day I would stop what I was doing and review and see where I've been selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid and do the whole deal and pray back into my day and look at how I can have a better attitude going through my day. And so I found this really tremendous sense of direction from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Would y'all agree that having a good sense of direction is a powerful thing? Second piece of the power came from the program. Six or eight months into the deal, we're in a meeting one night. And Joe was into service, so he had me make coffee. He first night he says, okay, you're going to make coffee for the next year. And I went, I don't like coffee. And he said, I didn't ask you to like it. I asked you to make it. I said, I don't know how. He said, I'm going to teach you how. So he taught me I make great coffee now. But he said, okay, and blah, 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 blah. And so I'm in a meeting one night, and the meeting's over, and we're cleaning up. And this guy had walked into the room. His name's Gene. And Gene was nasty and had blood on him and had dirt in his hair and mud on his face and ripped up clothes, and he stunk really bad. And the meeting gets over, and I'm cleaning up the coffee, and I look over, and Joe is talking to Gene, and they're looking at me. And I'm like, oh, shit. Sure enough, Joe walks over there and goes, Robbie, that guy's name is Gene, and you're going to be his sponsor. And I looked at Joe and said, no, hell, I'm not either. And he said, yes, hell, you are. And I went, what do I do? He said, you do exactly what I did for you. You don't tell him what to do. You show him what to do, and you lead him through the book and do it with him. So I walk over there to Gene, and Gene says, are you Robbie? I go, yep. He said, are you going to be my sponsor? I said, it depends. He said, on what? I said, are you willing to go to any length for victory? He said, yes, I am. And I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. And we went to meetings together every day, and we sat down after the meeting, and we read the big book. I read it to him mostly. And we did what it says, and Gene got sober. Gene lives in Louisiana now. I see him about once a year. I'm doing a retreat for men in Covington next year, and he'll be there. And I get to do that every 3 years over there for that crowd over there. And, you know, it was just a miracle to watch this guy have a transformational experience with God through what we do. And I found for myself, for the first time in my life, this incredible sense of purpose in giving what's been given to me to somebody else through this program. Would y'all agree that having a sense of purpose is a powerful thing? It's crazy. So I had the hope of the fellowship, the direction of the program, and the purpose of helping others. And I don't know why this is true, but I can tell you that it is. It happened to me, and it's happened to every single person that's done this way, is somewhere in the process they'll come to this realization one day that the whole time God's been doing for them what they can't do for themselves, and they're free. So I'm a big believer in the triangle and the legacies of AA because that's where I found my higher power. Today I don't introduce myself necessarily outside of my story as a church guy. But when somebody asks me to define my God, my answer is, I don't know. Because I've gotten open-minded enough to quit trying to define God. I really believe that if you think you understand God, you've made God too small. Because if you only let God be as big as you can wrap your head around him, then you've limited God to your idea. And to me, that's not big enough. And so I don't know. I've seen Buddhists get sober. I've seen Muslims get sober. I've seen Native Americans get sober. I've seen Christians get sober. I've seen Jews get sober. And I was talking to somebody before the meeting. I've seen atheists get sober. And they all find a higher power in this program. And it's not always God. Sometimes it's the Great Spirit. Sometimes it's Allah. Sometimes it's Buddha. For one atheist friend of mine, it's the incredible infinite energy of the universe. He's a neurosurgeon. He's been sober for 18 years. He works at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. So that's how I've developed my relationship with God. It happened as the result of active participation in the fellowship, active practice of the program, and a willingness to give away what was given to me every time I get a chance. I always keep one or two newcomers on my list of sponsees. I have about 50 sponsees right now, from 33 years sober, 35, whatever it is, down to my new guy's got 2 months. And we all do the same thing. It's kind of cool when you've been sober a long time because I don't have to sponsor that many people. I just go, I can't sponsor you right now, but I know somebody who will. I just go get one of my guys and go, you're going to sponsor him now. And so that's how we do it. My newest guy, besides my brand new guy, is a guy named Colin. Some of y'all know Colin. And he got his first sponsee day before yesterday at our home group. And he gave him the exact same directions. Are you willing to go to He did all that. Told him to call him every morning at 8 o'clock. He called him at 8:30 yesterday. Didn't call him today. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, my home group's a vision for you in Birmingham at the club, new clubhouse there in Hoover. And some of y'all are members of that group that are in here. And I love it. It's my home. I was taught by my sponsor I need to find my people. And that's my people. So what's it like now? I got a few minutes and I'm going to quit. In less than 6 minutes, okay? Hopefully y'all aren't dead yet. So I started dating a person when I'd been sober for a year and a half. My sponsor wouldn't let me date anybody for a year because y'all know why. That's not true. I dated a person for 5 weeks when I'd been sober for 6 weeks. I don't have time for that story. It was insanity. But then I promised I wouldn't do that again. And I went for a year with celibacy. And then at a year and a half or so sober, I decided, and my sponsor by then was a different guy. I changed sponsors because my first sponsor relapsed. Guy saved my life, and then he relapsed. I'll always be grateful. I don't know if he ever came back. I got another guy. His name was Julian, who passed away a year or so ago with 57 years sober. Great guy. I started dating. My sponsor said I could date. So there was this girl in my home group back then, and she hadn't dated anybody for 4 years. The reason she hadn't dated anybody is because she had been sexually abused her entire life by her male members of her family, and she was really traumatized. And so 4 years into her sobriety, her sponsor finally told her she could start dating somebody, and she wanted to go out with me. And I said, okay. And she said, I don't know how to do this. And I said, I don't either. And she came up with this really novel idea. She says, why don't we practice this? And I said, okay, let's practice. So we learned how to go out and be friends and have dinner and have hiking trips and go canoeing and go to concerts. And we even had sex every once in a while. But it wasn't about, I had learned in AA from guys how to treat women as children of God instead of sex objects. Because I didn't know how to do that before I got here. Even in my marriage. And so we had a really great 6 months. And then one day we were at a function, an AA function on Sunday afternoon in Phoenix City at a friend's house. We used to get together and have potluck on Sunday afternoon and play volleyball just about every week when it was good weather. The AA community would show up. And I'm sitting there eating spinach dip. I remember this very vividly. And I'm with this other woman. And the door opens. And this woman walks in with long blonde hair, and she's dressed nicely, and I look up, and I am smitten. And I hate to admit it, but it's true. What I looked, I know this, I didn't know it at the time, but when I looked up, what I saw was a really sexy, really pretty, younger version of my mother. Yeah, I was overwhelmed, because I love my mother, but I didn't see that in this woman. So we started talking. And we talked for a couple of hours. Now, the other woman, we were just practicing. She was the coolest lady in life. So we get through, and I got to take this other lady home that I've been practicing with for 6 months. And she looked at me and said, so, I guess we're done, huh? I said, yep, think so. And so I started dating this new woman. Her name's Janet. 6 months later, we got married, and we've been married for 35 years. It's been my experience with her and her AA was we don't go to meetings together. We never have. We do now, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But we decided that it was better for her to have her group of people and me to have my group of people and her to have her home and me to have my home so we could be free to share with our people. And we never mixed that fellowships together ever, except for speaker meetings. And that worked for us very well. 6 months later, we decided to get married, and I'll have one or two little things to say, but this is how it went. This is how it started. First marriage, 1,000 people, president's there, news media's there, I'm drunk as shit. It was a production. I didn't feel married at the end of it. I felt tired. Second marriage, me, Janet, her son, Wesley, my stepson, and a preacher. Same place, not the at sanctuary of the chapel. We're in there, and we're getting ready to get married, and the preacher looks at us and says, we need to figure out how to include Wesley in this ceremony. And he said, why don't we hold hands at the end of this and say the Lord's Prayer? And Janet got really excited because she'd been taking Wesley to AA, open AA meetings forever and to Alateen stuff. He was 9 when we met. He was 10 when we got married. And she got right, yeah, he knows the Lord's Prayer. We can do that. So we get married. I'm telling y'all, this time with just us in the room, I had this, what felt like an electrical charge go through my body. And I got married. I got married that day. And we get through, and I hold her hand, and I hold Wesley's hand, and he holds the preacher's hand, and we say the Lord's Prayer, and Wesley goes, keep coming back. It works if you work it. The preacher goes, what? I go, private joke. Don't worry about it. And, it's hilarious. So our marriage started with, you know, experience in AA, and I would say after the first 2 years of our marriage, it took a while to get married. Like, you work out things for a couple of years. I would put my marriage up against anybody's. I think I've got the best marriage I've ever heard of. I really do. Maybe not better than yours, but it's damn as good, I promise. And here's what it's like now. 7 years ago, almost 8 years ago, my wife got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And I was getting ready to retire, and she had retired, and it was devastating for me. But what happened is amazing to me is that I got really more involved in AA, because I believe when you go through a crisis, you need to lean on God. And where I find God is the program, the fellowship, and service. So it's what I do. And I said this to somebody before the meeting is, when you've got somebody who's that sick and that unable to function and you've been married to them forever, what you do is you find a new way to love them. And my way of loving her came from y'all, because I get to serve. I don't get it back. I get to do it for fun and for free. Well, I get to do it expensively and for fun, really expensively and for fun. I take her to AA meetings now. She can't remember what AA is necessarily. One of her sponsees is sitting in here. Suzanne's here somewhere. And, she helped her get sober. And it was nothing for me to come home at night at 7 or 8 o'clock after work and Janet be sitting in the den talking to some new woman, and I would get told to leave the room, you know, and I'd go somewhere else. We go to AA together now because I have to take her a lot of the time, and I don't want her to be alone. And, you know, they get to the end of the meeting, and they say, raise your hand if you're willing to be a sponsor. She raises her hand, you know, and she doesn't know. But every once in a while, we get to go around the room at the end of the meeting and introduce yourself. I'm so-and-so. I'm an alcoholic. And usually they skip over her because she doesn't know what to say. But every now and then, she'll look at me and go, well, I'm an alcoholic. And I go, yes, you are, Janet. And she's proud of that, you know, and so... y'all just taught me how to love people. I just know that before I got here, I had no conception of what it means to love somebody. And today I know that there's many ways to love you and me and her and anybody. I'm extremely grateful, and I'll end with this. It's a quote from somewhere, but it says that the natural progression of gratitude is humble generosity. And if it's not, it's not gratitude. It's something else. It's probably satisfaction or something else. And so what I know is that I'm extremely grateful that I get to be up here talking to y'all, because it saves my life. And I'm humbly grateful to be able to be generous enough to do this for fun and for free. So I'm really glad to be here, and I appreciate y'all putting up with me for past my bedtime. So thanks for letting me share.
Please stay standing and we'll close with the Lord.